Hi again, everyone. This is Gail Jaffe from SPRC, and we are going to get started with today's webinar. So I would like to welcome you to our program today. It's a research to practice webinar, and it's hosted by the SPRC Training Institute. Like I said, my name is Gail Jaffe, and I'm a senior prevention specialist with SPRC, and will be moderating today's webinar. And with me, I have Tiffany Kim, SPRC Project Coordinator, who will be providing technical support for us. So at this point, you should all be able to not only hear me, but see a slide up on your screen welcoming you to today's webinar and also including the title of today's webinar. And it is Tip 50, Addressing Suicidal Thoughts and Behaviors in Substance Abuse Treatment. Our presenter today will be Dr. Kenneth R. Connor, and in a few minutes, I will introduce him to you, and he will begin his presentation. So right now, you'll note that your phone lines will be muted during this entire webinar because we've got a large number of people participating in today's event. Right now, I can see from my control panel that at least 160 people are participating in this webinar, and I would imagine that we're going to continue to have people join us as we continue to go through the introduction. So at this point, if we were to unmute your lines, you'd notice that the background noise would be pretty distracting, which is why we're going to keep you all muted. But then following Dr. Connor's presentation, you'll be able to submit your questions and comments via the questions pane on your screen. And at that point, I will read your questions aloud, and Dr. Connor will respond to them. So at this point, hopefully I have not lost you, but just in case, we are going to get a quick orientation to the web interface, and I will review a couple of features for you so that you can fully participate in this event. Okay, so right now, you should be logged into GoToWebinar on your computer and looking at the PowerPoint slide that welcomes you to the webinar, which I've just advanced. And if that is not your experience right now, if you're just on the phone but you are not able to actually log in to the webinar or see the slides and you need some technical assistance, please call our Training Institute staff at 307-438-9322. Or you can email us at webinar@sprc.org. And again, that number is 307-438-9321. And the email address, once again, is webinar@sprc.org. And remember, you only need to contact us through that email address or phone number if you're needing technical assistance right now. So in terms of the GoToWebinar interface, there are really two parts that you'll need to know about right now. The viewer window on the left side allows you to see the PowerPoint presentation that we'll be following today. And then the control panel at the right side makes it possible for you to participate in today's event. By clicking on the orange arrow that you see towards the top of the control panel, you can open and close that panel itself. You'll also see a way to raise your hand as well should you encounter questions during today's webinar. And then by clicking the symbol to the left of the word questions, you can open and close the questions pane itself. So if you'd like to ask a question or send a comment to us, simply type in your question and click send. And at the end of the presentation, we'll have a question and answer session to answer as many questions as we have time for. And I'd like to let you all know, too, that today's PowerPoint presentation will be posted to the SPRC website within the next day or so, and you'll be able to download a copy of the presentation by going to our homepage, www.sprc.org. Clicking on SPRC Training Institute's link, which will be on the left side of the homepage, and then selecting Research to Practice Webinars, and also clicking the title of today's presentation. And I will shortly just post the URL for that website in the chat box that you'll see. So where like the questions and answers will be posted publicly so that you all have that URL handy. And I'd like to also mention that today's webinar will be recorded and an audio file will be posted with the slide presentation at the same section of our site. So you'll be able to not only look at the slides, but also listen to the audio along with those now. So Tiffany, if you could start our audio recording now. Great, thank you. So again, for those of you who have just joined us, I'd like to welcome you to today's Research to Practice webinar hosted by the SPRC Training Institute. And at this time, we have just under 200 people connected to this webinar, and I am happy to report that about 435 people registered to attend the webinar today, and those people hail from 41 states in the United States, as well as I know we had a registrant from Canada, and I heard we had one from New Zealand as well, possibly other places. So I'd like to welcome you all today. And now we will move on to our presentation. And today we are most fortunate to have Dr. Kenneth Connor with us. The title of his presentation is Tip 50, Addressing Suicidal Thoughts and Behaviors in Substance Abuse Treatment. And Dr. Connor is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Co-Director of the Center for the Study and Prevention of Suicide at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. He has training in psychology and public health and specialized training in suicide research through an NIMH-sponsored postdoctoral fellowship and a NIAAA-sponsored Career Development Award. His suicide research primarily focuses on alcohol and drug use disorders. He was the chair of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration Center for Substance Abuse Treatment Panel that developed a treatment improvement protocol, otherwise known as TIP, for suicide prevention entitled Addressing Suicidal Thoughts and Behaviors in Substance Abuse Treatment, and led the effort to create a VA-sponsored training tape based on the TIP, and you'll hear all about this today. So I know that you're eager to hear what Dr. Connor has to say, and I will yield the phone line to him right now. Tiffany, if you could please unmute Dr. Connor's line. Thank you.
Thanks so much. It's a real pleasure to speak to you today about TIP 50. And I was certainly honored and thrilled to get the invitation to give this webinar this afternoon. To give you a little bit of background about TIP 50, it's a manual that's published by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And at SAPSA specifically, it's published by the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment. This is a picture of TIP 50, what I'll be describing today, and it's about a 150-page manual that's written for clinicians. More specifically, it's written for substance abuse treatment providers, their supervisors, and substance abuse treatment program administrators. It's also written for any any clinician that routinely works with substance abuse patients. So what is the nature of the TIP? Again, TIP stands for Treatment Improvement Protocol, and SAMHSA has now put out 50 of these practical manuals. So it's a practical manual for providers that spells out recommended practices. It was developed by a panel of researchers, clinicians, and administrators with expertise in suicide and substance abuse. And the panel actively sought input from expert field reviewers, stakeholders, and an advisory panel. At this point, the TIP has not been formally evaluated or tested. However, there is an evaluation of a training tape based on TIP 50 that is currently being conducted in the VA. And I'm directing that evaluation of it. So who was on the TIP 50 panel that put this together? I was the chair of the panel, and that's why I'm speaking to you today about it. And then we had a number of expert clinicians and researchers who developed the clinical guidelines and the administrator guidelines in the TIP. And then we had a second panel of substance abuse administrators specifically who helped put together the recommendations for implementing the guidelines spelled out in the TIP in real-world substance abuse treatment programs. So how is the TIP laid out? The first section of it is a focus on skills and knowledge for substance abuse counselors and supervisors. So really, this is the clinical section of the TIP. Part two is a section written for program administrators to walk them through how to implement the TIP in their substance abuse treatment program. And then finally, there's a web-based bibliography that is not part of the manual itself, but somebody who's interested in looking at research on substance abuse and suicide would go to the web, and they can find a regularly updated bibliography. The goals of TIP 50. So what were we trying to accomplish? First, we wanted to help counselors and their supervisors by increasing their motivation, their self-efficacy, and their ability to manage suicide risk in substance abuse treatment settings. So in terms of motivation, one concern is that substance abuse counselors may not feel that this is part of their scope of practice. And we really wanted to change that idea and really invite substance abuse counselors to be a critical part of suicide prevention. Substance abuse patients often, it's not uncommon for substance abuse patients to have suicide risk, and it's necessary for counselors to be prepared to deal with that. We also wanted to help counselors with their self-efficacy, their sense that they can play a meaningful role in suicide prevention. And finally, we wanted to give them concrete knowledge and skills so that they can do good work in this regard. And second, we were also thinking of administrators when we put the TIP together, and we wanted to really enable administrators to implement the TIP in their treatment settings and really increase their motivation and self-efficacy to follow through. In terms of the part one of the TIP, we review risk factors, warning signs, and protective factors for suicide, and I'll be speaking about that in a few moments. We also go through a number of points to keep you on track, so to keep a counselor and their supervisor on track as they work with suicidal patients. And then really where the rubber meets the road in the TIP is the core strategy that we lay out called GATE. And this strategy consists of gathering information, accessing a supervisor, taking one or more appropriate actions, and then finally extending the action beyond the immediate crisis. And I'll go through GATE in some detail as we move on. Also in the TIP are a series of six detailed vignettes. And the vignettes actually take up the bulk of the TIP. So we have the educational stuff in the beginning, more or less, and then we try to bring it to life through these clinical vignettes, which are really fairly detailed moment-by-moment descriptions of how counselors and supervisors are managing high-risk situations. The vignettes are all different. In a couple of the cases, there's a suicidal issue, but it's not necessarily an acute crisis. And then we also describe a couple of situations that are quite acute and require immediate and intensive action. In the vignettes, there's a detailed dialogue and case description. There's a series of how-to boxes that provide step-by-step techniques and procedures. And then there's a master clinician notes, and you could think of these as little thought bubbles coming up from the counselor, where you basically see what they're thinking aloud as they work with patients. Chapter 2 is an administrator's guide, and we provide clear strategies and tools to implement the TIP in real-world substance abuse treatment programs. We describe different levels of capability depending on the size of the program, the staffing, etc. And then finally, there's part 3, which is the lit review and bibliography that is posted on the web. And I don't know if this will be as exciting to clinicians. Certainly, researchers might like to know that there's a detailed bibliography about suicide and substance abuse available on the web. And certainly, counselors are invited to go there as well, because there's some very nice articles, including review articles, posted there. And it's updated every 6 months for the next 5 years. So, as you might expect, we provide definitions related to suicide. One is suicidal ideation, also referred to as suicidal thoughts. And we simply define that as the idea to carry out an act of suicide. We define suicide attempt as a deliberate, self-injurious behavior with at least some intent to die that is non-fatal. So that's a bit of a mouthful. Essentially, a suicide attempt is an acute action one takes in an effort with at least part of the agenda to kill oneself. And certainly, ambivalence in suicide is typical, and oftentimes part of a person wants to live as well as wants to die. But for an act to be considered suicidal, there must be at least some suicidal intent. So, for example, cigarette smoking or drinking would not be considered suicidal, because an intent of that action is not to kill oneself. Suicide is a suicide attempt, essentially, that results in death. So a suicide has also been described in the literature as suicide death or completed suicide. And then one thing the TIP does not focus on is non-suicidal self-injury. And that's a deliberate, self-injurious behavior with no intent to die. And that could be burning oneself with a cigarette or cutting oneself, self-mutilation, which is quite common in younger individuals and in some clinical populations. And that's a big topic in and of itself, and we didn't tackle that issue in the TIP. I'm going to be talking about some administrative considerations. Although I think all the clinicians in the audience are going to be quite interested in this, because you can really think about your own programs and where you stand in terms of capability for suicide prevention, and also you can give some good direction to administrators at your sites. Our recommendations for administrators: first, you must be able to articulate the goals and objectives as they relate to suicide risk management. A written risk management plan must be in place. Protocols accessible to all staff must provide clear guidance to the staff for suicide risk management. So if somebody comes up to an administrator and says, "Where's your suicide protocol?" the administrator is going to want to be able to answer that question. And also, if a staff member is asked that, they're going to want to know exactly where to find that. There should be standardized methods of documentation of suicide risk. Typically, this involves folding the suicide risk assessment and the interventions right into the treatment plan. Recommendations continued: that personnel on the staff are trained to a level of competence consistent with their training and licensure. That staff are knowledgeable about the social and medical resources available to suicidal clients, particularly those resources available in the community, but not necessarily at the clinic. That community relationships are developed and maintained to support interventions with suicidal clients. Some substance abuse programs can do everything, but most cannot, and they need to have cooperative relationships with other providers. And then crisis services need to be able to be brought to bear, either within the program itself or cooperatively with other agencies. We describe three levels of substance abuse treatment program capability in the TIP. Level one is the lowest level of capability, although level one programs are able to do all of the things that I just described. Next level up is level two. And level two programs have at least one staff member with an advanced mental health degree. These programs are capable of continuing treatment with clients with suicidal thoughts or behaviors. So these programs can continue to work with a suicidal substance abusing client and would not necessarily need to refer that client out from the program. Level two programs have formalized ongoing relationships, either within the agency or externally, with mental health professionals trained in suicide prevention, and they can offer help to level one programs. And then finally, level three programs have all of what we've already described and more. These programs are linked to a mental health facility or a hospital that provides security for acutely suicidal clients. There's a capacity for suicide watch. There's a capacity for in-house comprehensive suicide risk assessments. And there's the ability to legally detain clients. So effectively, these are programs that are contained in hospital settings where the full continuum of services from emergency department to inpatient hospitalization, et cetera, are able to be provided. Common malpractice failures. I certainly suicide probably more than any other clinical problem scares the heck out of people. And we certainly don't want people to be practicing defensively or practicing with malpractice in first and foremost in their minds. That's not going to be helpful, and it can get in the way of doing good work. But nonetheless, I'll run through some common mistakes that people make that can create additional liability. One area is failures in assessment. One such error is the failure to gather information about suicidality. In every intake assessment, certainly there should be a mention of suicidality, either it's present or absent, and if it's present, some description of it. A failure to consider information about suicidality and treatment planning. So it doesn't do any good to gather the information and then not to do anything about it. A failure to recognize risk factors and warning signs as they emerge during treatment. A failure to obtain records from other sources that would have indicated risk. So if a patient is coming from the emergency department or some other acute setting, certainly the treatment program would want to get a hold of those records. And part of their interest would be in if there are indications of suicidality. Another category of malpractice failure has to do with failures in treatment. For example, the failure to consider the impact of an intense treatment program on suicidality. I suppose an example would be a therapeutic community. If a therapeutic community was treating a fragile patient, let's say a schizophrenic patient with a history of suicidality, and they were providing an intense confrontational treatment approach, and that patient took his own life, that program could be liable for delivering that sort of intensive confrontational treatment to a fragile and vulnerable patient. Another type of failure that's quite common, actually, is the failure to prepare a client for treatment transitions, including administrative discharges. It's not unusual in substance abuse treatment programs for patients to be discharged due to noncompliance or due to ongoing substance use. However, if a patient is judged to be at risk, or if there is a reasonable way of assessing and determining that a patient is at risk, then it would be irresponsible to discharge that patient without making arrangements for ongoing mental health care or for otherwise addressing that risk. Another failure in treatment is to make appropriate referrals for clients with suicidal thoughts or behaviors. So you don't want to be a treatment program with tunnel vision who just deals with substance abuse and only substance abuse. And if there are issues, if a patient has suicide risk and the program is not able to deal with that themselves, then they really need to refer that patient out for mental health care and for treatment of the suicidality. Another malpractice failure is the failure to follow up on referrals. This happens all the time. For example, referring a patient to the emergency department, but never finding out what happened or seeking to coordinate care with that department. Another category of malpractice failure is the failure to safeguard. The first two bullets here largely refer to inpatient or residential settings where there's a failure to take the necessary action to prevent suicidal behavior on a treatment unit. Another failure in this regard is to consider the impact of medication use by clients who are potentially suicidal. So, for example, giving 5 refills to a patient with a suicide-related history or who's at risk you know, failing to consider the potential that patient might store up their medication or use that medication in an overdose. And then finally, failures in documentation. This is also quite common. So you don't want to cheat yourself by not documenting the good work you're doing. And the rule of thumb essentially is that if it's not written down, it didn't happen. So it's very important to include in treatment plans what you're doing with suicidal patients. It's also very important to include when you've gotten supervision or consultation to deal with a suicide patient to write down in the record that you obtained that consultation. I'm considered an expert in this field, but that's something that I always do in working with a suicidal patient is I get some additional input from another provider who I trust, and then I document in the record that I've done that. So now I'm going to be talking about clinician and supervisor considerations, you know, very squarely and sort of moving on from the administrative section of the tip. First, I'd like to conduct a poll with you. And here's the poll question, which asks, the fundamental difference between a warning sign and a risk factor is, and please choose your answer, and then we'll talk about it briefly.
Dr. Connor, this is Gail. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading aloud the four answer choices. It looks like they're cut off on the slide that people are actually able to see right now, so that would enable them to be able to vote at this point.
Okay, sorry. There was a mistake made in transcribing these answer choices. So the first choice is there is no difference between warning signs and risk factors. The next choice is risk factors indicate acute risk and warning signs indicate chronic risk. The next choice is warning signs indicate acute risk and risk factors indicate chronic risk. And finally, the last choice is that risk factors protect clients from suicide and warning signs create risk.
Great. Thank you for doing that.
Sure. And I see that we've got a really sharp group, and that two-thirds got the correct answer. And it may be that those of you who couldn't see the whole question might have been thrown off a bit as well. In any event, the correct answer is that warning signs indicate acute risk, and risk factors indicate more enduring risk or chronic risk. And I'll be talking about that some more as we go forward. I'm trying to advance the slide and I can't. Can you help me out? Beautiful. So risk factors, these are more enduring indicators of risk. They include a prior history of suicide attempt. And actually, this is the strongest risk factor for suicide, is a prior history of attempt. Another important risk factor is a family history of suicide. Another that's particularly appropriate for this discussion is severe substance use. So all things being equal, a substance abuse client with a more severe substance use disorder, for example, dependency on multiple substances or onset of dependence as a earlier middle teen, that person is at somewhat greater risk. Another risk factor is co-occurring mental disorder. And really, depression stands out in this regard with this population, including substance-induced depression. And sometimes clinicians make the mistake of being cavalier about substance-induced depression, thinking that somehow that doesn't feel as bad as a depressive episode that doesn't have anything to do with substance use. But in fact, depression is depression, and it feels awful whether or not somebody got it because they were drinking or using drugs chronically, or got it independent of substance use. And so don't be fooled into thinking that if somebody has a depression that is attributable to, say, chronic drinking, that somehow they're protected. There are also personality issues that drive risk, including the tendency to feel negative emotions such as sadness and anxiety or anger, and then aggression or impulsive characteristics. And then in the personality disorder spectrum, there's the best evidence for borderline personality disorder as conferring risk among substance abusers. And sometimes people are cavalier about this disorder as well, but in fact, borderline personality disorder is not only a potent risk factor for attempted suicide, it's also a very potent risk factor for completed suicide. And borderline patients can and will kill themselves. History of child abuse is another risk factor. And within this domain, sexual abuse in particular stands out. Stressful life circumstances is another area to pay attention to. And in particular, interpersonal events are implicated in suicidal behavior among substance abusers. Most commonly, breakups in partner relationships or threats to breakups. So if a substance abuse patient experiences a breakup and they seem to be distressed by that or troubled by that, that's really worth paying attention to in terms of suicide risk management. Also, a number of other stressful life circumstances might be seen, including employment difficulties, legal difficulties, financial difficulties, etc. And then another important risk factor is firearm ownership or access to a gun. More than half of suicides in the U.S. are carried out with firearms, and firearms are the most lethal form of self-injury. So firearm suicide attempts are usually not survived. They're usually lethal. And paying attention to firearm access is especially important in preventing suicide death. I'm going to talk about warning signs. And warning signs, as nearly all of you knew when you took the poll, warning signs indicate more acute risk. So they tend to signal that suicidal behavior might be around the corner. And what I'm going to be talking about first are direct warning signs. And these in particular need to be paid great attention to clinically. One such warning sign is suicidal communication. Someone threatening to hurt or kill themselves, or talking of wanting to hurt or kill themselves. Another warning sign is, direct warning sign, is seeking access to a method. So somebody trying to acquire a stash of pills or seek out a weapon, or on a treatment unit trying to seek out a method of hanging or what have you, that's clearly a warning sign. And then finally, making preparations. Someone talking about or writing about death or dying, making out a will, giving away possessions, in any way sort of working toward an act of suicide. Of these various categories, probably the biggest myth has to do with suicidal communication. And I've often heard clinicians and lay people say, well, if somebody really wants to do it, they wouldn't talk about it, they would just do it. And that's actually not true. Most people who kill themselves and most people who attempt suicide talk about it in some way beforehand. And that provides a really nice opportunity for risk recognition and for intervening. There are also indirect warning signs, and these can be remembered through the word is, or through the phrase is path warm. And you can see these more indirect warning signs listed here. And the reason they're thought of as indirect warning signs is that they may or may not indicate suicide risk. For example, some substance abuse patients present as being angry and reckless, but in some of those individuals, suicide might be the furthest thing from their mind. And so with the indirect warning signs, the necessary thing to do is to probe deeper and to see if it might be an indication of risk for suicidal behavior, or it's merely sort of something else going on with the patient. Certainly, if there are a lot of these indirect warning signs in play, that is especially worrisome and reason to really pay attention and to do further assessment. We've got another poll. The only thing I'd like to add to this poll is that choice C, that's the third one down, that should read, increasing protective factors can be a useful strategy to lower risk. That's an incredibly good audience. Wow. Okay. The answer is both B and C. I actually thought this would be a harder question, but I failed miserably to make a harder question. it's both B and C. So protective factors may be overwhelmed by risk factors, and the bottom line here is to not put too much stock in a protective factor, and I think this is a common clinical mistake. So a patient might be flush with risk factors and warning signs, and a clinician says, "Well, they have they have a close relationship with their mom who brought them in," as though that would save the day in the context of all these other signs of risk. So you don't want to put too much stock in a protective factor. And then choice C is also true. Increasing protective factors can be a useful strategy to lower risk. That's really where protective factors can come in clinically, as they can be really important things to focus on, to shore up, and to help a person become safer. So, for example, if a person thinks of a real reason to live as being the need to take care of their child, then that would be something. That relationship would be something to pay attention to clinically, and that wish to care for that child would be something to shore up and to focus on in the discussion in the suicide prevention intervention. Okay, we can move on. So I'm going to talk about protective factors that are both known and presumed. And when we say presumed, it's just because there isn't very good data on protective factors, and we need a lot more research on them. So some of these things are just common sense things that we think would be protective, but there aren't necessarily hard data on them. One protective factor is reasons for living. Another is being clean and sober. The third is attendance at 12-step support groups. This is one of those things where there isn't a stitch of data on it, but clinically, it makes sense that if somebody's well-connected with 12-step treatment, such as Alcoholics Anonymous, they have a sponsor, et cetera, that could be protective for vulnerable patients. Another protective factor is religious attendance or internalized spiritual teachings against suicide. So this is something you don't want to get in the way of. If a patient has strong religious teachings against suicide, that may help save their life, and you don't want to in any way challenge or interrupt that patient's belief that helps them stay safe. Additional protective factors. Presence of a child in the home and or child rearing responsibilities. An intact marriage. Trusting relationship with a counselor, physician, or other service provider. And being employed. We talk about in the tips some points to keep you on track. One point is to appreciate that almost all of your clients who are suicidal are ambivalent about living or not living. Ambivalence is the rule of thumb with suicidality, And you can even see this in suicide deaths, where people will have hesitation wounds on their temple before they shoot themselves, or on their wrist before they cut themselves. So even people who are very deadly and ultimately follow through tend to show ambivalence. And clinically, you can really take advantage of that and work with people on that side of themselves that wants to live. Suicidal crises can be overcome. This is really helpful clinically as well. Even the most severe patient is not typically suicidal. You know, they might have some suicidal thoughts, but the vast majority of patients are non-suicidal most of the time. And then when crises hit, or they have a change in status, for example, they enter into the depressive episode, then they become at greater risk, and the trick becomes to get them through that episode. So it takes some of the pressure off of clinicians that, you know, patients have some, even high-risk patients have some natural built-in protection, and most of the time, they're not acutely suicidal. Another point is that although suicide cannot be predicted with certainty, a risk assessment is a valuable clinical tool. So we researchers have failed miserably to predict suicide in clinical populations. And that is not going to change anytime soon. So we don't know what patient is going to take their own life using existing tools, etc. But that does not in any way imply that a clinician is not responsible to do the very best they can in terms of a risk assessment and enacting sound clinical judgment in doing their best to prevent suicidal behavior. Another point is that suicide prevention action should extend beyond the immediate crisis, and this is the point in GATE around extend the action. It's a common clinical mistake is to treat suicide prevention as a one-shot action and not to think in the longer term about follow-up actions that are needed to manage risk over the longer haul. In the tip, the panel took a fairly strong position that we do not recommend suicide contracts, and they are never sufficient. The mistake with suicide contracts is, one mistake is that a counselor feels like they've done suicide prevention by having a patient sign a piece of paper. And that is not a therapeutic action. And certainly it is in no way protective from liability that one has a patient sign a piece of paper promising that they won't harm themselves. Suicide contracts, more often than not, get in the way of good engagement with a patient and working realistically with them on what can make them safe. We talk about in the tip an alternative to a contract, and that is safety planning or developing a treatment plan to deal with suicide, which is a very meaningful thing to do. Some clients will be at risk for suicide even after getting clean and sober. So, for example, a patient who gets clean, but they have a mood disorder that persists, that mood disorder can create risk in that person just like they would anybody who doesn't have a substance abuse problem. Suicide attempts must always be taken seriously. We mentioned before that suicide attempt is the single most potent predictor of eventual suicide, and so these are not things that should be treated cavalierly. Suicidal individuals generally show warning signs. So the good news about that is they give us hints that they're at risk and there's an opportunity to intervene. Clients should be asked about suicide and asked directly. There's a longstanding myth that a counselor might make a patient suicidal by asking about suicide. There's certainly no data to suggest that that's the case. And the consensus among researchers and clinicians is that with this issue, it's really important to be direct with patients and ask them in no uncertain terms about if they're feeling suicidal or have plans to commit suicide. This next point is a little more abstract, and I'll take a moment to explain it. And the point here is that the outcome does not tell the whole story. As you can appreciate, suicide is a low base rate phenomena. So many of our patients are at risk, but relatively few of them kill themselves. At least relatively few of them kill themselves during the time when we're engaged with them. And accordingly, somebody could be doing really, really poor treatment and still have a patient survive. And the fact that the patient lived is not an indication that good clinical care was given. So I've seen more times than I'd like to admit clinicians sending a patient home without doing an appropriate assessment or taking appropriate preventive actions with that patient, and the patient doesn't follow through and hurt themselves. And a naive clinician could think that, oh, there was never really any issue to begin with, or that I did good practice. And I do not think that is the case. On the flip side, it can be the case that a clinical team does everything that they in their power to prevent a patient's suicide, and the patient takes their own life nonetheless. And so in this case, a tragic ending does not necessarily indicate that poor treatment was delivered. And one would need to review exactly what was done with the patient to make any determinations about judging the outcome. So be careful not to judge the clinical care provided based on the outcome alone. Another point is don't become the suicide interrogator. This happens very commonly where clinicians become anxious about suicide, and in that anxiety, they ask rapid-fire questions or they seek false reassurances from patients that they won't hurt themselves and really get in a big hurry with this issue. And we really encourage you to slow down, to relax, to not grill the patient with rapid-fire questions, but rather to talk with them therapeutically the way you would any other issue. Finally, realize the limits of confidentiality and be open with your clients about such limits. And one of the discussions that should occur with the initial intake appointment is limits of confidentiality in the case of suicide, acute suicide risk. Now I'll talk about GATE briefly. This is the four-step process for managing suicide risk in substance abuse treatment. Step one is gather information. Step two is access supervision. Step three is take an action or actions that are appropriate to the given situation. And then finally, extend the action beyond the immediate situation. So what does gather information mean? There's two parts to this. One is to screen for suicide risk. So, for example, in every substance abuse program, there should be standard questions that are asked of all patients to see if a conversation about suicidality is needed. A screening question could be, have you thought about killing yourself? That's a pretty darn good question. It's direct, and it's clear what the meaning is, and it invites a clear response. And then if a patient says, yes, I've thought about suicide, then one would want to ask follow-up questions to get the scoop. The first follow-up question would be an open-ended one. Can you tell me more about the thoughts? And then if you didn't get all the information you wanted, you would follow up with more specific questions. For example, what brings the suicidal thoughts on? How strong are they? How long do they last, etc.? You could think about this the way you would think about gathering information about any therapeutic issue. For example, with craving, you would ask, can you tell me more about the craving? And then you could ask any number of follow-up questions. For example, what brings the craving on? How strong does it get? How long does it last when you have craving, etc.? So you can essentially you ask about suicidality the way you do any therapeutic issue. Step two is access supervision or consultation. And we distinguish two types of accessing supervision. One is immediate supervision, and this is those situations where, as a counselor, you're concerned for the patient's safety if they were to leave your office, and you want to talk in real time to your supervisor to get some input in order to make a plan. And then regular supervision are those non-acute situations that can be talked about at your weekly meeting with your supervisor or at a weekly team meeting. So these tend to be non-acute situations. So example of an immediate supervision situation would be a patient who relapsed. They come in, they're very upset about what happened, and they're having thoughts of killing themselves. That would be a situation you'd want to get some immediate supervision and input before that patient went home that day. A regular supervision could be a patient who made a suicide attempt a month ago, and they're feeling better now. They have no ongoing thoughts or plans for suicide. They're sober and clean. They're connected with their self-help treatment. That would be a situation where you darn well want to talk with your supervisor about that suicide attempt that occurred a month ago, and think about how you can enhance the treatment plan around that. But that isn't a situation where you necessarily need to grab a supervisor right then and there before the patient left. Taking action. The key principle with this is to match the intensity of reactions with the severity and immediacy of risk. And really, the principle here is to use common sense. So, you know, it's easier to think about mismatches than matches. So a mismatch would be, you know, a patient has a gun in their trunk and they're intoxicated and they're talking about getting in their car and going to shoot themselves in the park. And you tell them to come back next week for a regular appointment. That would be a gross mismatch. You can also think of mismatches on the other side. Let's say a patient disclosed that a year ago they made a suicide attempt, and since then they've been doing well and had a good adjustment. You would not march that patient down to the emergency department for an immediate evaluation. That would be a gross mismatch in the other direction. And most mismatches are more subtle than that, but that's just to make the sort of the point. So potential actions. In the tip, we list a number of potential actions that can be taken, including gathering additional information, which is always a good thing to do, including from records or from family members, from other providers, arranging a referral, very common action, increasing the frequency of care, including more frequent telephone contact. That can be a very helpful temporary action. Involving a case manager, involving a primary care provider. Encouraging attendance in 12-step meetings. Involving family members or other supports. This is very helpful. You live with the patient an hour a week. If it's an intensive outpatient treatment, maybe 6 or 8 hours a week you see the patient. But family typically see the patient every day, and they can really be your eyes and ears and spot a situation where the patient is entering into more acute risk or showing additional signs of danger. Also, family members could be excellent supports for patients. So identifying healthy family members or healthier family members and engaging them in treatment can be a dynamite way to make the situation safer. observing the client for signs of a return of risk on an ongoing basis, reducing access to methods of suicide, means matter. I'm going to be talking about a training tape based on Tip 50 that is now available, and there's a detailed section of that tape where the substance abuse counselor works with their suicidal patient around his access to a gun. And I would recommend anyone interested in this issue to view that training tape and to see how that counselor handled that very difficult issue. Potential actions continued. A written safety card is a staple of suicide prevention, where a patient is given a wallet-sized card with key numbers on it, including a 24-hour crisis number, the counselor's contact information, and then additional supportive individuals that are specific to the patient. These cards can be made up ahead of time, and then the client's specific information around their personal supports can be added. And then the notion of extending the action beyond the acute risk. So suicide prevention efforts are not one-time actions. Ways to extend the action. Confirm that a client has kept their appointment. Follow up with a hospital emergency department to see what's being done. Also, if you want to have leverage and input, give that call to the emergency department and tell what you're seeing and thinking, and make your recommendations to them. Coordinate with other providers on an ongoing basis. So if the person is in mental health care, have some contact with that mental health provider and get particularly with a particular interest in any indications of return of risk or how you might be helpful in that regard. Check in with a client about any return of suicidal thoughts or repeats of suicide attempts. Observe the client for signs of return of risk. In group treatment, observing clients for changes in mood and emotion and being withdrawn can be very useful. Keep family members engaged, as we discussed. Confirm that the client still has their safety card. Ask them to take it out of their wallet. Review it with them as a reminder. Confirm that a client still does not have access to a major method of suicide. So you've taken an action to deal with the patient's stash of pills, but follow up to see if that's still the case, if there still is no such stash on hand. Follow up with the client if there's a major change, for example, if they relapse to drug use or alcohol use, if a major stressful life event occurs, if they've had a breakup in their relationship, you'd want to check in with them at that point about suicidality. And then document all relevant information. Update the treatment plan. Give yourself credit in writing, in the record, for the good work you're doing. That's all I had to say about Tip 50. In a moment, we'll entertain questions. First of all, I encourage you all to order Tip 50. I hope that my ultimate hope is that every substance abuse provider in the country has it on their shelf, and not only on their shelf, but they use it. It doesn't sit in the cellophane wrap. Good news is it's free. It can be ordered by contacting SAMHSA on the web or by phone. Also, I mentioned a video training tape. Let me spend a minute talking about that tape. The VA sponsored the making of a training tape based on Tip 50, and that tape is now completed. And SAMHSA has a couple thousand copies of that tape that we've sent them. That training tape is not copyrighted. It can be used just like the manual can be used by any program, by any staff. And it's an hour and 15 minutes long, and it shows an expert panel of clinicians walking through the steps and gait. And then it shows a series of vignettes where the skills are actually performed by a substance abuse counselor and her supervisor with a client at risk. The client depicted is a young Hispanic male who relapses, and his girlfriend kicks him out of the house, and he becomes acutely suicidal, including an idea to shoot himself. And the substance abuse provider is shown do an excellent job of managing risk within the framework of GATE. So I'm hopeful that everybody on this call can not only learn about suicide prevention through this TIP 50 training, but also can be an agent of change in their own programs and can be sort of a standard bearer for suicide prevention in your agencies. And a neat way to do that would be to get a hold of this training tape and make that available to staff, as well as the TIP 50 manual. And the training tape is a real nice introduction to the manual, and then the manual can serve as a standalone resource. So don't be shy about calling SAMHSA and saying not only would you like TIP 50 manuals for your agency, but you'd also like a training tape. And you can tell them that I sent you to ask about that. They know who I am. And I believe that's it for our the presentation. And at this point, I'm happy to field questions.
Dr. Connor, thanks so much. That was great. And I know that you just covered a whole lot of ground. So I'm imagining that people are going to be kind of formulating their questions as we get into the Q&A portion. I do have a couple of questions right now in the queue that we can start with, and then as more come in, I will continue to pose them to you. So the first one comes from Jose Villegas. I hope I got that right. And his question was something that he had posed while you were talking about risk and protective factors, and he was wondering where the PTSD that say, like military personnel or law enforcement officers might experience, I would imagine in their line of work, if I'm understanding his question correctly, would fit into the risk factors that you talked about.
Great question, Jose. Yes, PTSD would be considered a risk factor. There actually isn't as much research information on PTSD as we would like, and we don't know at this point if it poses the same kind of risk that, say, major depression poses. But we assume it does confer risk, and certainly with populations like you're describing, people coming back from serving in Iraq or Afghanistan or with prior service history, police officers who might have experienced trauma on the job, people who've been raped or sexually abused or had other traumas, you certainly, with those individuals, you want to assess PTSD, and you also want to assess suicide risk and consider that in your treatment planning.
Great, thank you. I have one question that is in the queue from Ann Kirkwood, but first I just wanted to let a couple of people know that I posted a link in the chat box to everyone that has that's the URL where the slides and the audio from today's webinar will be posted, and that should happen within the next day or so. So if you're looking to get a copy of the PowerPoints to be able to review and also to listen to the audio, if you'd like to do that as well, please check that link within the next day or so. So Anne's question has to do with rural and frontier areas, and she had been asking about in these areas where supervision might not be available, the practitioners who are in those areas might be young or inexperienced and possibly not linked to clinicians with more experience out there. So she was wondering what are some of the ways that a rural slash frontier provider could obtain appropriate supervision at the right time in the GATE steps process?
Thank you for that question, Anne. That's a very tough issue, as you know better than me. I think the main thing is to plan ahead. So as a substance abuse provider or a mental health provider, you need to have the assumption that at some point a suicidal patient is going to present, including an acutely suicidal patient. And you need to have a plan in place of response. Now, that response would certainly be somebody that you could get a hold of by pager or get a hold of in real time. You would also want to have an emergency plan in place that might include contacting a local emergency department or police department to come in order to escort a highly acutely suicidal patient to the nearest hospital for evaluation. I think that although having access to that kind of supervision in terms of face-to-face is probably improbable, if not impossible, on the frontier, certainly one could make arrangements ahead of time to have that sort of access through electronic media, through the phone or what have you. And I certainly appreciate that that's a tougher challenge in smaller agencies, and especially in smaller agencies in rural areas.
Thanks so much for answering that question. I am seeing one from Larry Wilson that sort of speaks to a larger clinical question, but we'll pose it to you as well. So his question is, how do you deal with clients who present as suicidal but who know the language, the clinical language enough, not to say something that might necessitate a call to police for emergency protective custody?
Well, thank you for that question. We don't have the ability to read patients' minds, and some patients will have the ability to withhold from us what they're really thinking or feeling, despite our best efforts. And that is a reality we're sort of saddled with. I can say, however, that I think that the clinical responsibility and the clinical opportunity is to make that patient as willing as possible to trust you and to open up and to be forthcoming. And sometimes even patients who are very anxious about revealing their suicidality, are very hesitant about it, they will do so in the right sort of therapeutic atmosphere. So if an atmosphere of trust is built between you and the patient, an atmosphere in which you're a patient listener, and you know, the patient really trusts that you're going to work with them on no matter how difficult the issue, particularly if you're going to work with them collaboratively rather than in a dictatorial way, I think you'll be surprised how often that patients will disclose, you know, what is going on with them.
Great, thank you. So we also have a question that came in from Tina Granger, and her question had to do with whether a clinician would be personally responsible for negligence with regard to suicide should the clinician not follow up with a referral. And she noted that many clinics do not require this follow-up practice and was wondering if this was relative to state law.
I'm not a lawyer, and I just don't have the expertise to comment on the liability in a situation like that. Certainly, if I were going to court, I would feel better if I had followed up than if I had not followed up. And it may be a hard thing to explain to a lawyer or to a judge why you didn't follow up. And certainly the much safer thing to do is to follow up. And clinically, the better thing to do is to follow up on all our referrals to see what happened.
Great, thank you. I would like to invite participants to submit any questions that they have for Dr. Connor right now using the questions function on your control panel to the right. Right now, we do not have any questions in the queue, so I'm just going to give people another minute or so to submit questions that they might have. Okay, I've got one question that just came in from Kate McHugh. And she was wondering whether you would offer your thoughts regarding the efficacy of gatekeeper training in terms of substance abuse and suicide prevention outcomes in terms of creating best practice strategies in community responses to prevent suicide and reduce suicidal behaviors.
Well, GATE really is a gatekeeper training, as you might appreciate, given our acronym GATE. In terms of data, interventions, be they gatekeeper related interventions or otherwise, with treated substance abusers, in terms of research information, is few and far between. Certainly, Marsha Linehan at the University of Washington has done some really excellent work with DBT, with substance abuse populations. Greg Brown and his colleagues at Penn with cognitive therapy have done some beautiful work with largely suicidal patient populations that have shown efficacy. In terms of the effectiveness of those fairly intensive treatments, more research needs to be done. When we designed GATE, we started with, rather than start with theory or start with efficacy research, we sort of started with the reality of the frontline substance abuse provider and supervisor and administrator, and thought considered what kind of treatment recommendations we could make for the a typical provider, and we assumed that we would not have infinite time to provide training and infinite time to provide supervision of training. So we were really needing to design a manual that was very straightforward to understand and to implement and could be implemented without any specialized skills or mental health training. And this is what we came up with. I guess ultimately the story will unfold in the coming years whether or not this is becomes an empirically supported approach. Certainly it's a sensible approach to try, given the realities of substance abuse treatment as it's practiced in real world settings.
Great, thank you. So I am looking at one more question that has to do with whether or not you would recommend that all substance abuse clients develop a safety plan regardless of risk factors or warning signs?
Well, I would say no. If If it's your clinical judgment that a patient has no history of suicidal thoughts, has no history of suicidal behavior, and there are no indications that that person is really entertaining ideas like that, I wouldn't necessarily think that they would have to develop an individualized safety plan. At the same time, I actually know a colleague named Richard Reese and William Voss at the University of Washington who are developing a standard group educational module for substance abuse patients that could be delivered right in the context of typical care. And although that intervention doesn't necessarily involve an individualized safety plan, nonetheless, it involves psychoeducation and et cetera for all patients. And that kind of thing is probably warranted because of the high prevalence of suicidality in treated substance abusers. My research shows that about 50% of treated substance abusers have no history of suicidal thoughts or behavior. And so I would say for that 50%, I'm not sure that there would be a rationale necessarily to develop an individualized safety plan with them focused on suicide. You would probably think about other targets of treatment with those patients.
Great, thank you. So at this time, Dr. Connor, I would just like to thank you again for presenting during today's webinar. I feel like you covered a tremendous amount of ground and really brought TIP 50 to a place where it was all of the content in it was extremely accessible, and it was just really informative all around, and I think gave participants a good amount of food for thought and also directed them to better understand how they can use TIP 50 in the different settings in which they work, and also how to access copies of that and how to access the video that you described as well. So again, I'd like to thank you, and I would like to thank everyone that participated on today's webinar. And like I said earlier, the slides and the audio from today's program will be posted on SPRC's site within the next day or so, and that link was reposted for anyone who didn't get a chance to see it earlier. So with that, I would just like to, again, thank everyone, and take care. Bye.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Bye.